All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Please be seated. Good morning. The court has three matters on its oral submission docket. Justice Heck is sitting in each of these matters, but has had a family emergency, so he will not be present for oral argument this morning. Justice Green is not sitting in the latter two causes. In the order of their appearance, the causes set for submission are docket number 050300, N. Ray Brookshire Grocery Company, and original proceeding. Docket number 050147, City of San Antonio versus Mark Hartman et al. From Bexar County and the 4th Court of Appeals District. And docket number 050171, Southwestern Bell Telephone Company, LP, DBA, SBC, Texas, versus William C. Mitchell, beneficiary of Louise Mitchell, decedent, from Bexar County in the 4th Court of Appeals District. The court has allotted 20 minutes per side in each of these arguments and will take a brief recess between the arguments. We expect to complete all of them before noon. These proceedings are being recorded, and a link to the arguments should be posted on the court's website by the end of the day today. The court is now ready to hear argument in 050300 N. Ray Brookshire Grocery Company.
May it please the court, it's been a race to present argument for you later. Later, we're at 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Deborah Race. I'm here on behalf of Brookshire Grocery Company in this mandamus proceeding. I know the court has read the briefs and is familiar with the issues. Briefly, as the court recalls, this involves the trial court's granting of a motion for J&OV that had an alternative request for new trial in December. In January, we filed a motion for new trial within the 30 days of the signing of the judgment.
Why didn't we get an order granting leave?
We wouldn't
be here today.
You would not. And in hindsight, I sure wish I had gotten an order granting leave, Your Honor. What happened in this case was the original motion for J&OV. I added the motion request for new trial due to some overlap in the issues. Particularly, we were arguing for J&OV on the ground that there was no evidence for the type of lawsuit they presented. But in companion with that, our issue that's run throughout this case was submission of the charge, which in an alternative argument I said would justify a new trial. At the hearing, and I think the court's familiar with the transcript of the hearing, the court indicated a desire to simply rule on the motion for entry of judgment as well as the J&OV, and in my opinion at least, invited to go ahead and file the comprehensive motion for new trial at a later time, which we did. And then the court set that, heard that, and granted that. But Your Honor's question, and you are correct, I think the two...
So are you asking for a rule that if a judge says... You're relying on what the judge said at the hearing on the J&OV or on the fact that the judge subsequently granted the motion?
I'm relying on basically the entire record. I think the idea of leave is permission and notice, and at all times in both the motion and everything that we did, I think there was plenty of notice. I also think the record from a standpoint of leave, if your Honor will recall, one of the key issues in the briefing here is not really to do with whether or not we had leave. It is whether or not an amended motion itself can trigger an additional 30-day plenary power, period. And if you will read in Ms. Goss's briefing, as well as in the trial court, I don't believe there was ever any question of leave. As a matter of fact, at the hearing on the motion for new trial...
Ms. Rachel, let me jump in here. That,
sure.
That comment surprises me a little bit. Your brief at page 18 says that Brookshire is not advocating that the court's plenary power was extended by its amended motion for new trial.
Well,
it seems, I thought as Justice Brister was asking about, suggesting that leave was crucial to your argument. Are you saying it's not?
No, Lee, I'm sorry, and maybe I misspoke. Leave is crucial to my argument. I guess my argument is that any motion under 329B is going to extend the plenary power. The two arguments that I had before Texarkana, which Texarkana rejected, one was that the court had never actually granted the first motion for new trial. Texarkana correctly points out that the order that was submitted to the court for signing says motions, and I think that argument is, I'm going to be beating a dead horse if I try to return to that simply because of what that order said. I do believe that the court's intent was not to rule on the motion for new trial at that time. But as far as leave, yes, I do. And if I misspoke earlier to Justice Brister, I apologize, because I do believe leave is critical. What I was trying to say is in this case, I think the record supports leave. The Texarkana court found that the record supported leave. In response to your question, I sure wish there was an order because it would be simpler, but I don't think it would solve the entire problem because Ms. Goss's position is that regardless of leave or not, that 329B doesn't allow any.
Well, let's inquire about that a little bit.
Yes.
In a normal case, say there's not an amended motion. If the trial court denies a motion for new trial, how much longer does the trial court have jurisdiction?
If there are no other pending plenary power extending motions, then it's 30 days after the order denying same.
And so why wouldn't the rule be that you needed to get a ruling from the trial court within 30 days after he originally denied the motion for new trial? You can file amended motions, and maybe there's leave, but the trial court must act within 30 days of his denial of the motion for new trial.
I think that's the key issue here, because the way I read the rule, he does not have to act within 30 days of the denial of the original motion for new trial if any legitimate plenary power extending motion is filed, and that was our position, is that the second motion was filed with leave, and again, that's going to be an issue, but presuming it was, that the second motion was filed with leave, then I think his plenary power is extended. In other words, in the way I read the rule, it says if a motion for new trial is timely filed by any party, the trial court has plenary power to grant a new trial until 30 days after all such timely filed motions are overruled. And that is actually more than the leave issue. That is seems to be the real debate with the real party in interest, is whether or not, and again, the Court of Appeals relied heavily on the opinion in Dickinson, which went back to a historical note that said it applied only to original motions. And our argument is under a plain reading of 329BE, I believe our burden is to show that the second motion was timely. And if it was timely, then I think the court's plenary power was extended. So, pardon me.
So I understand what you're saying. If my guess is that 75 days, of course, is to give the trial court time to hear and rule upon the motion for new trial.
Yes, I believe that's right.
If the court rules on it, in this case, the next day after the judgment's entered, then, of course, you don't need the 75 days. Then the 30-day period kicks in. You're saying that if there is an amended motion, leave is granted to file an amended motion. It opens up the entire 105 days at that point.
I believe it does, Your Honor. I believe under the rule it says if a motion for new trial is timely. So it's my position that the only question to be answered is whether or not our motion is timely.
So it resuscitates plenary period.
I think it does. I think that's a good way to put it. That you've got the maximum, and I'm going to look back on the page of my brief, because if I misspoke in there, what I was saying in my brief or trying to say is that it in no way extends the maximum period of plenary power. As this court knows, there are several plenary power extending motions that can be filed after a judgment, so that one ruling on a motion for new trial doesn't cut off the court's ability to rule on another type of plenary power extending motion, such as to correct, modify, or reform.
Okay, now does it have to be characterized as a motion for new trial or amended motion? Right? If somebody files a motion to reconsider I guess you can consider that a...
I believe you can consider that if it complies with the rules, and that's why in reading the rules, and again, I looked at the rules during this entire matter, and the way I read the rule was if a timely filed motion is on file, the court has time.
But if you're just asking the court to reconsider its ruling, it doesn't seem that there is a requirement for leave to file that. Just said, Judge, I want you to hear and think about this some more.
No, there would not be. I don't think if you characterized it a different way, but I'm not going to try to make my motion, the second motion, anything that it wasn't. It was a motion for new trial is what we asked for. And again, I think here the record belies any argument that we didn't have leave or permission of the court to do so. If you read Judge Boswell's comments at the motion for JNOV, he expressly told me that today I just want to take, I'm not really wanting to get into the new trial. I don't want to cut you off, but I'll hear it later. And in my opinion, that was saying, go ahead and file it, bring it in.
All these motions are intended to get a ruling from the trial court or an overruling by operation of law. Why shouldn't the rule be that once the motion for new trial is ruled upon, I mean, that's what the whole the Rule 329B is talking about, that the trial court has 30 days from that point to act, period. And so that if you want to file an amended motion within the 30 days of the judgment, that's fine, but you need to have a hearing and a ruling on that before the 30 days expires after the court has ruled on the motion for new trial.
And I think the rule certainly could be that. I don't read the current language of 329B to mean that in light of the fact that it says all such timely filed motions are overruled. So I think the plain language of the rule states that if you have a timely filed motion, you have plenary power for 30 days after all such timely filed motions for overrule. Something else that I submitted to the court as a supplement to our appendix, when I was preparing for the briefing, which this case is actually on a direct appeal as well, I came across a dialogue between the judge and counsel for both parties at the conclusion of the hearing for the motion for new trial. Judge Boswell expressed great interest in the issue, said he had struggled with the issue of the charge at trial, that he would like more time, and expressly asked counsel, how much time do I have, at which time Ms. Goss's counsel answered, you have several weeks. I agreed, and he said, I will, then you let me know if my time runs out.
Of course, this is a matter of jurisdiction.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It is a matter of jurisdiction.
You mentioned that there is an appeal. What's the... how do you explain the adequacy or not of an appellate remedy?
Well, the adequacy of the appellate remedy for the issues that are on appeal is certainly has not been impeded in any way. Our issues were with respect to charge error that we believe require reversal in this case as well as evidentiary claims. I do believe in this case that Judge Boswell, based upon his comments at the both hearings, had serious considerations about how...
I'm asking, could the Court of Appeals say that the trial court had jurisdiction to grant the new trial?
No, that is not even an issue before that court at this time. There was a mandamus to that court which has been... was granted filed by Ms. Goss. The only issues raised in the direct appeal are taking that the motion for new trial was not granted and that we are attacking the charge error and the evidence.
There's no question about the timeliness of your notice of appeal?
No, thank heavens. Your Honor, there's no question about that.
Are you saying Dickerson is distinguishable or is it just flat out wrongly decided?
Well, I think Dickerson is distinguishable, which is what I argued to the Court of Appeals, and rereading their opinion, and I don't have my brief to that court, but in Dickerson, they seem to think I was arguing one thing, and I'm not positive that's how I slanted it, but in Dickerson, both motions for new trial were filed before an order overruling the motions was signed. Then, one thing that I thought was really interesting in Dickinson was it was the judge left the bench that heard all of this. It was a new judge, and then not only that, he recused himself. So it was an assigned judge that in February granted the motion for new trial. So there were some distinguishing features in Dickinson, and I don't really believe that this court was ever presented with any question of timeliness of the second motion, or was, I couldn't tell from the opinion if the order overruling overruled both or only overruled one. I know the order granted only granted the amendment. But I do think, in additionally, Dickinson's reliance on a historical note in the rule that, frankly, and I brought my rule book, I don't see that note in there anymore. But I believe that was a little, at least, misleading for a practitioner who is reading the rules, perhaps not reading the Vernon's version. But to me, reading the rule that says you've got 30 days after all such timely filed motions are overruled, my position then, at the time I read it, was we've got 30 days because my motion is timely. And so I guess in that respect, I think Dickinson had some dicta in it that might have been misleading. And I see my time is up, so I will reserve my remainder.
Thank you. The court is ready to hear argument from the real party.
May it please the court, Mr. Michael Young will present argument from the real party.
May it please the court. The current system of deadlines for post-judgment motions, for invocation of appellate jurisdiction, and for termination of trial court jurisdiction dates from 1981. In that year, this court rewrote Rule 329B, and in various sections of that rule drew textual distinctions between motions for new trial and amended motions for new trial. In 1998, the court in Dickinson, per curiam, interpreting those sections, held that filing an amended motion for new trial does not extend the court's plenary power. And it relied on the historical note to the 1981 amendments, which says an amended motion for new trial gains no additional time. And it accordingly held that the trial court's plenary power expired 30 days after the overruling of the motion for new trial and granted a writ of mandamus against the trial court to require the setting aside of an order granting an amended motion for new trial signed after that plenary power period had expired. The same result was reached by the Tyler Court of Appeals in 2003 in Morris versus Morris and by the Court of Appeals in this case.
If Dickinson doesn't apply if the trial judge granted leave here, right?
Dickinson applies whether or not the trial court granted leave. What Dickinson says is that an amended motion for a new trial, regardless of leave or timeliness or anything else, does not extend plenary power.
Is an amended motion where leave has been granted, is that timely?
Well, until yesterday, I thought the answer to that question was yes, and I'm not sure it is on reflection. Under the pre-1981 rule, leave of court did not relate to timeliness. The pre-1981 rule said a motion for new trial may be amended within 20 days after the motion is filed and before it is overruled. And it said with leave of court. And this court, in the Turnbow case in 1945 and the Consolidated case in 1963, said leave of court is not part of the jurisdictional element of that rule. It is a procedural step. Its omission is a mere flaw, not a jurisdictional defect. All right, if you accept that holding, then under the current Rule 329B, an amended motion for new trial may be filed, and then it says without leave of court, before any preceding motion for new trial filed by the movement is overruled and within 30 days after the judgment. So it is arguable that leave of court or no leave of court, the time to file an amended motion for new trial is 30 days and before the original motion is overruled. So if that is correct, then leave is really not a material issue here because this motion was filed after the preceding motion was overruled, and that would be the end of the hunt on that point.
But that could happen before you even have a judgment. I mean, a motion for mistrial is, in effect, a motion for new trial, right?
It is.
So if I move for mistrial during voir dire and it's overruled, a motion for new trial has been overruled, and you never can.
Well, that
that's a problem, isn't it?
Under, I think it's Rule 306C, that prejudgment motion is deemed to have been filed the instant after the judgment is signed. I guess you then have the question, does the prejudgment order overruling that motion, is it deemed to have been entered the instant after that motion was filed? I think there's a possibility that an overruling after the judgment is required in order
there's
to
no rule, but there's no rule that says that. And here,
no, but you'd have
I'm troubled here. I mean, the trial judge says, I'm going to enter the judgment so you can go ahead and proceed on then with the motion for new trial. That would make me, as a reasonable lawyer, think I could still file a motion for new trial and didn't have 90 days, et cetera, for the judgment.
It would me too, Your Honor. But then when I get an order on day one saying your motion for new trial is overruled.
Well, it didn't really say motion for new trial is overruled, did it?
It said your motion for judgment, notwithstanding the verdict, and alternative motion for new trial has been considered, and said motions, plural, are overruled. The order used plural.
Oh, but I mean, I understand that. I just, I mean, it looks like, of course, the judge probably did the judge draft that, or did your client?
I'm afraid we drafted it, Your Honor.
Oh.
Well, on January 25th, according to this record, even you thought the court had several weeks.
Frankly, Your Honor, we thought the motion for new trial was going to be overruled. We raised in our response to the motion this jurisdictional issue, but we thought it was going to wind up being moot because we thought the motion for new trial was going to be overruled. At that point, either the trial court's plenary power had already expired, the judge was asking, how much more time do I have? And I suppose I could have answered, well, either it's way too late already or you have several more weeks, depending on which side's argument you accept. But what I told the judge was that he had several more weeks, which would be accurate under Berkshire's interpretation of the rules.
Under the appellate rules, time to file the notice runs from the judgment, file a motion for new trial afterward, extends it to 90 days, and I don't... Is it, I mean, if you file a motion for a new trial afterwards, it doesn't matter whether it's a good one, a bad one, a with leave or without leave, that would be extended for 90 days.
It has to be a timely motion, but we do not dispute that the prejudgment motion for a new trial triggered the 90-day appellate timetable. And, in fact...
We kind of want these to work together, don't we? I mean,
well, but they don't work together. If no amended motion for a new trial had been filed, then it would be beyond question that on day 32 the trial court's plenary power would expire, and yet there would be until day 90 to file a notice of appeal. They simply, since one is tied to the judgment and the other is tied to the overruling of the motion for new trial, they don't always work together. And we think of the plenary power period as being a 105-day period. But that's sort of sloppy thinking because it is only if the motion for new trial is overruled by operation of law.
So really what it comes down to is because your opposing counsel had the courtesy, diligence, or foolishness to tell the trial judge before judgment was entered, I'm also wanting a new trial. If she just hadn't said that, then there'd be no question y'all wouldn't be here.
No, if her prejudgment motion had not included a motion for new trial, I don't know what she was thinking in doing that, but in any event, that's what was filed.
She was doing what all diligent attorneys do, you know. I want to win on this reason, that reason, another reason, and also any other reasons I think of here in the future.
As soon as possible.
Right. If she just hadn't had that diligence, then the motion filed after the judgment would have extended, the trial judge granted it, and
well, I submit
y'all would be back, y'all would by this point have tried the case over again and not be bothering us.
I submit there were other avenues of redress. After receiving the day one order, it's very clear under this court's decision in Moritz versus Price that whatever the timeliness or propriety of an amended motion for a new trial after day one, the trial court had 30 days in which to be moved by such a motion or by anything else that came into his head to grant a new trial. So upon receiving the day one order, at a minimum, a motion could have been filed and leave sought and obtained. Or if I'm right that once the motion, the original motion is overruled, it's too late, period, to file an amended motion. You could file the amended motion anyway. I've filed motions entitled things like motion for the court to exercise its plenary power. And under Moritz, anything that persuades the court to do that within 30 days is effective. I want to turn to the point about leave and whether leave was granted. First of all, we believe that where a matter has jurisdictional consequences, and if Ms. Race is right, then leave has jurisdictional consequences because it affects the timeliness of the amended motion. If a matter has jurisdictional consequences, the policy of this court has been to require a written order. That's true with respect to judgments that start the appellate timetable. It's true with respect to orders granting a new trial that abort the appellate timetable. And so here, in the absence of a written order, or at a minimum, a clear and unequivocal statement that is consistent only with leave having been granted, this court should not try to examine the record with a magnifying glass to determine what the appellate timetable and the plenary power period are going to be.
But in most contexts, when we're asked, did the trial judge grant leave, an oral order on the record, I'm granting leave, is good enough.
That is correct, Your Honor, but usually it requires something that is interpretable only as the granting of leave. If the court says that in so many words, we know what he meant.
What about a docket sheet entry signed by the judge?
A docket sheet entry, even if signed by the judge, is not under this court's precedence leave or a ruling.
That's correct. So why should this be any different? And we require lawyers now to specifically state their objection to a judge's ruling so that the judge can clearly understand what that objection is so that we don't have to try to interpret whether or not the judge knew what the line of question is going to be in a certain type of case, so we don't have to speculate. Why is this any different?
I don't think it is any different, and I don't think it's any different from a trial objection where instead of saying grant sustained or overruled, the judge says move along, counsel. You don't want, particularly where there are jurisdictional consequences at stake, you don't want to be trying to read between all those lines to figure out, well, was leave granted or leave denied when such weighty consequences turn on that.
And we don't want the appellate rules to be a trap, though, for the unwary either. We like to try to decide matters on the merits rather than on technicalities. The legal system should operate that way as well. Of course, there are important exceptions to that. There are requirements for preservation and timetables.
Rule 329B, Part B, is fairly unique because it sets up a different set of rules for amended motions for new trial from any other post-judgment plenary power extending motion. Under subsection E, I can file as many motions to modify, correct, or reform as I want, one after another, regardless of which ones have been overruled and which ones have not. But Rule 329B, Part B, says one or more amended motions for a new trial may be filed, and then it gives a different timetable than the timetable under Part A for original motions for a new trial. So there is a policy in the rules to treat those motions differently.
What does the language in Part B, without leave of court, what significance does that have? It sounds like, under your interpretation, that phrase could be left out and it would mean the same thing.
I think here's why it was there. Prior to 1981,
would you agree that if it said with leave of court, your view would be that it means the same thing? Your position, as I understand it, is it doesn't matter whether there was leave of court granted or not.
That is correct. An amended motion does not extend to leave.
Which is why I'm asking, what's the significance of that phrase, then, is to you in Part B?
Because prior to 1981, the rule said with leave of court, and yet you had precedents from this court saying, well, leave of court is a mere formality. I think in 1981, the framers said, if leave of court is a mere formality, then we're not going to require it anymore. And because the prior version of the rule said with leave of court, they put without leave of court in this version of the rule to reflect that the prior procedure was being changed.
What do we do with 329BE that says the trial court has plenary jurisdiction 30 days after all such timely filed amended motions are overruled? Your first point is it wasn't timely filed. And if it was timely filed, did the court have jurisdiction?
With all respect, Your Honor, it doesn't say amended motions. It says after all such timely filed motions are overruled. That presumably refers back to the beginning of that paragraph where it says if a motion for new trial is timely filed. Now, the rule seems to set up a distinction between the term motion for new trial, which refers to original motions, and amended motions for new trial, which refers obviously to amended motions. If you look at paragraph C, in the event an original or amended motion for new trial, et cetera. So if Part E had been intended to apply to amended motions, then the wording would presumably have been the same as Part C, if an original or amended motion for new trial is timely filed by any party, and then when it said at the end, all such timely filed motions, that would relate to both original and amended motions. But that's not how it was written. I want to turn very briefly to the issue of whether leave was granted. Again, if a written order is not required, at least an unequivocal statement of intent is required. Brookshire relies essentially on three things to establish that. First, the comments in the hearing on the judgment on day zero. Of course, at that point, filing a motion, an amended motion, was a matter of right. There was no need for leave. There was no question of leave. Then on the signing on day 29 of an order setting the amended motion for new trial for hearing. Well, setting an amended motion for new trial for hearing does not necessarily reflect leave for its filing. The first question out of the judge's mouth at the hearing might have been, well, counsel, didn't you need leave for this motion, and did I grant leave, and if not, why are we here? And finally, the order granting the amended motion itself is relied on in circular fashion as constituting leave for its filing. The problem with that one is that occurred outside the trial court's plenary power, and so if his plenary power had expired, he couldn't reinvest himself with plenary power by taking action after that point.
Would it be reasonable to conclude that maybe the judge changed his mind because there's no clear indication on what the judge really intended?
Well, he may have changed his mind, but if he decided on day 54 to grant leave, he was too late.
It is inconsistent with the notion that he did not mean when he said go ahead with your motion for new trial at day zero, that at that time he really was not intending to grant leave.
Well, if he thought he had no power to do so on day 54, I assume he would not have granted the motion. I assume he thought he had power as of that time. I don't know whether he thought about the issue of leave or not. If he did, maybe he thought he was granting leave. Maybe he thought he had previously granted leave. But if he hadn't previously granted leave, then the fact that he thought so on day 54...
But we know at least from the fact that he granted. This was the judge that tried it.
Yes.
And he was troubled about something in the trial and wanted to do it over again.
Yes.
And the Texas County Court said no.
As
because you don't have jurisdiction.
Right. As many courts have granted mandamus from post-plenary power new trial orders.
Mr. Young, assuming Ms. Rice's argument is correct and it was timely filed, timely granted, is this a proper subject of mandamus?
Well, to be quite honest, I have not considered that until Your Honor asked the question this morning. We do have a pending appeal from the original judgment in the Texarkana Court of Appeals. If, in fact, the Day 54 new trial order is valid, then that appeal is from a judgment that has been vacated and is subject to dismissal as such. So if Ms. Race were to move I guess she wouldn't dismiss her own appeal, but to dismiss it on the ground that it is taken from a no longer extant judgment, and the court were to grant that motion, then that would be indeed an adequate remedy of law. Now, that's not going to happen because the Texarkana Court has already ruled that the post-plenary power new trial order was improper. But they have that authority, and so if they were to grant that motion...
But that appeal is from the judgment.
That appeal is from the judgment, which under Ms. Race's theory no longer exists.
Right, but if that appeal from the judgment, one point in the in that appeal would not be this judgment's already been set aside. I mean, that's just... The appeal from the judgment is arguments about the jury charge was proper and stuff like that.
If the judgment has already been set aside, then the Texarkana Court is without jurisdiction to consider the appeal from a judgment which has been set aside and rendered interlocutory by the grant of a new trial.
There were plenty of times when it was uncertain whether the judgment was final or not where you would perfect the appeal but say maybe it's not final.
And, Your Honor, I have filed a motion to dismiss my own appeal on the ground that the judgment isn't final and said therein, I can't tell if this is final or not. I can't risk it not being final. In the Bolton case that this court decided just last fall, that was involved. Unless the court has anything further, that concludes my argument.
Thank you, counsel.
Your Honors, with respect to the question of leave, that was not an issue ever raised to the trial court. In response to our motion for new trial, Ms. Goss did drop a footnote with respect to how many times the court had rejected the arguments relating to the charge. Therein, she stated, this order terminated the period for filing amended or supplemental motions for new trial under Texarkana P. 329BB and triggered the final 30 days. Their position apparently at that time, although it was contradicted in the response to the court about how much time he had left, was that under Rule 329BB, with leave or without leave, that was not going to extend any of the court's plenary power. Now, in spite of the footnote, there was none of this was raised at the argument, and I respect the court's question earlier, and as well as Ms. Goss's position that if the trial court was outside of its plenary power at that time, then what difference does it make? And in truth, when preparing for the mandamus, I didn't even have the transcript from the hearing on the motion for new trial because at that time we were focusing on what had happened before. But I do think leave, under the way the rule is written, is critical. And whether I was diligent or foolish or whatever, what I was trying to do is tell the court what we wanted to do. As the Court of Appeals recognized, it was clear on the record what the intent was, and the reason for including the request for the new trial was simply due to the overlap in issues. Because it was our position that there wasn't the evidence to support the way they had submitted the case. Would I do it again? No. I will not do a companion motion or even a request in that.
Ms. Race, Mr. Young states that Rule 329B, Part E, applies only to motions and not amended motions. What's your response?
Exactly, and I think that's the crux and the heart of this entire argument. I certainly don't read the plain language of that rule to say that because of the part where it says until 30 days after all such timely filed motions are overruled. And the way I read that, I thought there were two steps. I thought you'd look at that and then you'd go back up to number A and number B to see if our motion was timely. And under B, it says one or more amended motions for new trial may be filed without leave of court or any preceding motion for new trial is overruled and within 30 days. I thought we had leave of court. I thought we had permission of the court. I knew we filed it within 30 days, and there we went. In my opinion, at the hearing on the motion for JNOB, the court made it clear, at least to me, that it did not want to take up all of the matters in the new trial.
What's the status of the appeal?
It has been briefed. It's ripe for submission.
And is one of those appellate points this case the trial judge has already granted?
No. And Your Honor, again, after listening to the last dialogue, I felt trapped once again because I went ahead and perfected the appeal. I sure wasn't going to be out with no appellate remedy. But the position I'm taking is, yes, of course, originally I thought granting the motion for new trial, that was all she wrote. They filed the mandamus. The minute that was filed, I thought I better perfect the appeal. The mandamus was to Texarkana. Texarkana rejected it. But the appeal is strictly on the merits. One other thing that I would like to point out in the conversation this morning, and I do realize there is a distinction between the appellate timetable to perfect the appeal and the plenary power, but I also think there is another distinction here. We are talking about when the trial court, at what point can the trial court rule on the judgment and the matters before it. And I think, again, this was raised as a mandamus proceeding. So there is a distinction, as far as I'm concerned, with when a litigant can file something and when it's timely and when the trial court can act. And in this case, I think the Texarkana court held that the trial court could not act, and I would just encourage the court to look at, there are some cases cited that says that with leave, the court does have to be held. For those reasons, I'd ask the court to reverse.
Thank you, Ms. Grace. The cause is submitted. The court will now take a brief recess.
All rise.